From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
Christy Whitman and the federal EPA have misled the public.
Toxic cover-up, asbestos, lead, mercury, dioxin, benzene. World Trade Center Syndrome. Today we'll meet a doctor who's treated a parade of Ground Zero patients, a lawyer working on behalf of police union activists investigating why so many cops are coughing, a parent whose son goes to Stuyvesant High School blocks from Ground Zero, where kids are suffering nosebleeds and other respiratory problems, an organizer who started a free mobile health unit to treat hundreds of sick workers, and a woman who was sent to the emergency room twice by the toxins in her apartment. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! The U.S. is under growing criticism for its treatment of Taliban and al-Qaeda prisoners from many different angles. UN Human Rights Chief Mary Robinson said yesterday the 50 Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters held at a U.S. naval base in Cuba were prisoners of war entitled to the protection of international law. Robinson said most legal experts disagreed with Washington's view that the fighters are illegal combatants and therefore not protected by the Geneva Conventions on Prisoner Rights. A senior British official interviewed by the Financial Times expressed dismay at the blunt language used by War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who said Tuesday he did not feel even the slightest concern at the prisoners' treatment. And London wants Washington to hand over British al-Qaeda suspects for trial to avoid a confrontation over U.S. use of the death penalty. The family of an Australian man captured with al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan is demanding he be given access to a lawyer and Australian diplomats as concerns grow about the conditions of his imprisonment. The 26-year-old David Hicks was caught 5 weeks ago, transferred to Guantanamo Bay last weekend with about 80 other Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. He's yet to be charged. And a battle has broken out between Attorney General John Ashcroft and lawyers who say they represent John Walker Lynn, the California-turned-Taliban warrior, about whether investigators improperly kept Walker from conferring with the lawyers while he was being questioned. If the courts agree, they could bar prosecutors from using the statements Lynn made during the 45 days he's been held. Secretary of State General Colin Powell arrived in the Indian capital today on a mission to de-escalate tensions between nuclear rivals India and Pakistan, which have massed troops along their borders. Powell arrived after a short visit to Kabul, where interim leader Hamid Karzai reminded him that many Afghans wondered whether Washington would abandon them after full victory over the former Taliban leadership, as it did after U.S.-backed rebels drove Soviet troops out in 1989. Powell pledged that Washington would not abandon the country. U.S. relatives of victims of the September 11th attacks are in Afghanistan, meeting with Afghans who lost family members in the U.S. bombing. The trip was organized by the U.S. human rights group Global Exchange. We go now to Rita Lassar. She is in Kabul. Her brother, Abe Zalmanowitz, died in the World Trade Center attack. He was on the 27th floor, but refused to leave until his paraplegic friend, Ed, was saved by emergency workers. They both died, along with more than 3,000 others. She speaks to us from Kabul.
We went from one ground zero, where we had lost many loved people, to another ground zero in Kabul, Afghanistan, where the people had lost many, many their family. But they had been suffering for 23 years. One family lost a brother and his wife who had just gotten married and were sleeping in their bed, and a bomb just came through their window and killed them. Another family lost three members of their family, and the children are orphaned now and living with the uncle. They're very happy that we have come as Americans. They want us to know that they are not angry at us. They are very happy to have been liberated from the tyranny, but they want us to help them.
Rita Lazar, victim of One Ground Zero, now visiting another, speaking to us from Kabul, Afghanistan. On the home front, the Washington Post is reporting politicians are scrambling to give away hundreds of thousands of dollars in Enron donations to distance themselves from the company as the scandal deepens. The Republican Party's three major campaign committees are dumping the biggest chunk of Enron donations, at least $280,000 altogether. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, meanwhile, says it'll give $100,000 in Enron soft money donations to charities helping former Enron workers. Numerous lawmakers also say they'll divest themselves of Enron contributions, but some are refusing, saying rejecting Enron's contributions would amount to an admission that the money was accepted unethically. These include Majority Whip Tom DeLay, Republican Congressman Billy Towson, who's also the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is investigating Enron. A failing student allegedly shot three people to death and wounded three others yesterday at the Appalachian School of Law. Among those killed was L. Anthony Sutton, a senior official in the President Bill Clinton Justice Department, who was a dean at the school. The law school, built in a refurbished junior high school, was founded by community leaders in Virginia to revitalize a region decimated by the decline of the coal industry. Former U.S. fugitive Sarah Jane Olson and four one-time militant comrades have been charged with a 27-year-old murder during a bank robbery. The four who were arrested yesterday and a fifth suspect who is still at large were members of the Revolutionary Symbionese Liberation Army, the prosecution charges. Olson turned herself in at her lawyer's office on her 55th birthday after prosecutors announced the surprising new charges, and just 2 days before she was due to be sentenced for attempting to blow up two police cars in 1975. The new charges scupper her hopes of a short jail term amid a U.S. crackdown on terrorism. Argentina announced yesterday emergency measures to feed the poor and considered using troops to distribute humanitarian aid to free up police facing rising unrest and protests over banking curbs.
Yo quiero saber cuáles las consecuencias sobre el trabajo en la World Trade Center.
What she wants to know is what are the consequences of working in the World Trade Center and like what can it cause her to her health. She has had like a lot of flu. She's been sick, like her blood and stuff.
Coming for very sick. I work in the cleaning apartments. In this area.
In the area of the World Trade Center?
Yeah. I work. I barely see this.
Your fingers are shaking?
Yeah. I don't know what happened. So maybe 50 days ago.
Marvin Gaye's What's Going On? Here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, with the sounds of workers near Ground Zero who have sought help at a mobile health unit that's just been set up. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are going to take a tour today of Ground Zero with people who've been working to find out what is there. On a tour of Ground Zero just 48 hours after the attacks, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, told reporters, "We haven't seen anything that would lead to long-term problems." Then several days later, she offered the following words to shaken New Yorkers: "I'm glad to report to the people of New York that their air is safe to breathe, their water is safe to drink." But 5 months later, the environment around Ground Zero seems less than safe. Doctors have diagnosed a new ailment called World Trade Center Syndrome. Residents are reporting nosebleeds and asthma. In an article in today's New York Daily News, Juan Gonzalez describes a toxic nightmare unfolding at a high school just blocks from Ground Zero. And Juan joins us again today for the second time back as co-host of Democracy Now! Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country, Amy. It's great, as I said, on Monday to be back.
So can you talk about, actually, during this period of the banning, while you weren't on, you were writing extensively for the New York Daily News, though not all your pieces were published, exposing the environment at Ground Zero. Tell us what you found.
Well, I had a series of reports beginning, I think as early as September 28th, I think was the first one, that began to question some of the reports that the EPA and New York City Health Department officials had been putting out about the safety of the situation in Ground Zero. I think one of the big issues was that there was an underestimation of the potential dangers from asbestos exposure to people in many of the office buildings when they returned. Clearly, as we will learn today, it wasn't learned until late September that the EPA early on had indications that there was considerable amount of asbestos in the dust and in the air around Lower Manhattan. Then subsequently, thanks to the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project that filed a Freedom of Information request, I was able to obtain the detailed monitoring reports, day-by-day reports of the EPA of its own testing, and was amazed to discover that in a variety of toxic chemicals and materials, the EPA had been on a pretty consistent level finding elevated readings above federal safety levels. Now, they have characterized them since then as basically spikes, occasional readings, but for instance, in the area of things like dioxin in the air, when you total up the number of tests that the EPA did on dioxin, elevated dioxin levels, they weren't just spikes. They were about half of all of the tests that EPA did showed elevated dioxin readings in various areas around Ground Zero. And of course, you have to understand that when you do testing of this type, you only do a limited number of tests. You might do 10, 15 tests on a particular day with some of these exotic, especially, chemicals. So you must assume that if in a significant proportion of those tests you're getting elevated readings, that means that if you had done even more testing, you might have found even more elevated readings, so that you've got a situation where you're getting a snapshot, and any elevated readings indicates that you have a potential problem. So I think, and this occurred in chromium, it occurred with benzene, it occurred with dioxins, in one of the reports, I think the one that created the most stir when I reported these findings, even the water that was being discharged into the Hudson River, for instance, on September 18th, the EPA did water tests from a runoff pipe on Rector Street, and the EPA's own reports said that they had found levels of chromium, copper, lead, and zinc at levels that, quote, were elevated to several orders of magnitude above ambient water quality criteria for most metals. And the tests found the highest levels of PCBs and dioxins in the sediment in the Hudson River right near the World Trade Center that had ever been recorded in any kind of testing that was being done. So in other words, what that was telling you was that the water that was leaving, that was draining out of the World Trade Center, was a toxic mix of a variety of dangerous chemicals, and that in essence was an indicator of what was on the site, because the water draining off would give you a good indication of what was on the site that was potentially dangerous. Since then, of course, there have been numerous reports that have appeared in other publications, lamentably not too many in the New York City area, but the Washington Post had a major story a couple of weeks ago. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch had a major story just this past Sunday by a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter talking about how health officials had not, all the questions about what health officials had told the people of New York about the situation with the air and the environment here. And now, of course, the EPA's own ombudsman has launched an investigation of how EPA has handled the reporting and whether the top officials at EPA misled the public about what was actually occurring in the air and in the environment around Ground Zero.
We're talking about the toxic cover-up at Ground Zero, and we're joined in our firehouse studio, which, by the way, I should say, is we are blocks from Ground Zero. We were inside the evacuation zone for many weeks, where just last week the Humvees have left, the Army, the State Troopers, the National Guard, who've been checking people who drive by this area. We're in a firehouse, ironically enough, for this period of time. More than 300 firefighters died on September 11th, and also more than 80 police officers. Joel Kupferman is with us. He's with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project, and he's been working with police union activists to uncover why so many cops are coughing. It hasn't been easy. And it's interesting because, I mean, the police are the establishment. So why is the establishment covering up, Joel?
I would say that they want to return to a state of normalcy, trying to get the World Trade Center area declared as being safe. And I would say literally they're taking the asbestos and all the dust and trying to sweep it underneath the rug. And now that the dust is beginning to come back. It was interesting that besides working for the police activists, we worked on behalf of many, many other workers and residents. And our office is even closer than the studio here. And the first few days, worker upon worker came up to us complaining, people coughing or whatever. And we started gathering information. We actually grabbed our own asbestos sample and we came up with a high reading. But we're speaking especially to the police officers, and we dealt with them over the West Nile virus spraying, that many of them complained to us that they were getting sick from the spraying last year. And then 2 weeks later, the World Trade Center incident occurs, and one of the police officers said he felt that many of his workers, I mean his fellow police officers, were being exposed needlessly. And also a lot of the police officers told me that when they went to their superiors, they were told not to complain and that their jobs were somewhat on the line. And they did ask for equipment, safety equipment, and they weren't given that equipment. So I think part of it is just, the main reason is that they really wanted to downplay any type of danger that was present.
We're also joined by Marilena Christodoulou, who is the head of the Stuyvesant High School Parents Association. Juan, you have a piece in today's New York Daily News on the whole controversy at Stuyvesant, one of the elite high schools, public high schools in New York City.
Right. For those across the country who are not familiar with New York City or with Stuyvesant High School, this is really one of the premier high schools in the city, where students have to take tough entrance examinations to be able to get into the school. As such, the students here really are the sons and daughters of many of them, of doctors and lawyers and professors, but many from poor backgrounds. But the most intelligent children among them in the public schools of New York City. And the Stuyvesant High School was really shut down only for a few weeks while after the attack. And on October 9th, the Board of Education cleared the school, supposedly spent about $1 million in a cleanup program, and then told the parents and the students that it was safe to go back. And I'd like Marilena Christodoulou to tell us a little bit about what the parents' initial reaction was to what the school board told them, and then what they discovered when they went back.
Well, our children have been back in school for about 4 months now. The Board of Education and other city officials, the Department of Health, have assured us that the environment inside the school is safe for our children's health. The case has been that there has been a lot of incidents of illness, both among the children and among the faculty. The Board of Education has...
When you say illness, what? What is the illness?
Illness, bloody nose, respiratory. We have children who have been diagnosed with chemical bronchitis. We have children with chronic...
Their noses just start bleeding in school?
Absolutely.
Yes, well, yes. I spoke to a parent who said his son has sudden nosebleeds now on a regular basis that weren't occurring beforehand, in addition to constant coughs every night and every morning when he gets up. And
But I think the important point is not what a parent says, but that these children have been diagnosed by doctors as diagnosable illnesses, like an illness that I had never heard of before, which is chemical bronchitis, and chronic sinusitis, and they're treated with heavy antibiotics and steroids and so forth. And there's also a general exacerbation of existing conditions like asthma and sinus infections and so forth. The Board of Education originally said that they would bring in the Center of Disease Control, a representative from the Center of Disease Control, to conduct an epidemiological study. That never happened, but I think the issue is not how many of the 3,000 children are sick. I think even one child with chemical bronchitis is one too many. This is a public health issue. It's not an issue of one child being sick. And we are very concerned. I have to admit that not the entire parent population, agrees with me, but in general, the vast majority of the parents are very concerned.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll speak with a doctor who's been treating patients at Ground Zero. We'll go out to the mobile health van that has just been set up in the last few days, been overwhelmed by the number of workers who have come to the van, many of them speaking only Spanish, to complain about all of the ailments that you're actually talking about right now of kids at Stuyvesant's High School. We'll also talk about the situation of workers, and particularly those who are afraid, who are undocumented workers, afraid to come forward when they start coughing and have difficulty breathing. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report as we continue with the issue of the toxic cover-up at Ground Zero. Stay with us.
Everybody look at your hands. We can dance, we can dance. Everybody's taking the chance. It's safe to dance. Oh, it's safe to dance. Yes, it's safe to
Men Without Hats, Safety Dance, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. As we talk about the toxic cover-up, the environment at Ground Zero, and what is this new ailment, this condition being called World Trade Center Syndrome. I'm Amy Goodman. My co-host is Juan Gonzalez. We have a roundtable discussion for this hour, and we're going to take this out nationally as well. Look at how to investigate sites that may be toxic, how people can find out. We are talking to Joel Kupferman with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project. Dr. Stephen Levin is on the line with us, medical director of Mount Sinai Hospital and Irving J. Selikoff Center for Occupational and Environmental Medicine. In the studio, Marilena Christodoulou, who is head of the Stuyvesant High School Parents Association. Wendy Tabb, who is a resident right near Ground Zero. Wendy, can you talk about where you live and what's happened to you since September 11th?
We live at Duane and Church, which is about 6 blocks north of Ground Zero. We fled our building the day that the attack happened, and we were gone for about 10 days. And we came back, pretty much immediately had symptoms that varied from exactly what you were saying before. Bloody noses, rashes on our skin, burning eyes. For me, I had a headache that started and just got so bad that I ended up in the emergency room. My husband has a pre-existing asthma, which has been under control until now. And it got to the point where he was literally sleeping two nights a week. He could not go without having severe asthma attacks. So we're not there anymore. We cannot stay in our building, which has not been properly tested or cleaned. So we are basically homeless or displaced for the time being because we get too sick when we're there.
I'd like to ask Dr. Steve Levin of the Selikoff Center for Occupational Safety and Health, who's on the line with us by phone. Dr. Levin, how many cases have you been dealing with that are similar to this one?
Well, our center has seen over 100, maybe we're up to near 120 individuals who have come to our center complaining of respiratory difficulties for the most part. Could you hear me?
Yes, and in terms of the what you've seen of the or what you know of the potential hazards that existed that might lead to some kinds of these ailments, could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When those buildings were hit and collapsed, and when so many construction materials went up in flames, it released a tremendous burden of irritant chemicals and dust. So you're talking about a combination of particulate material or dust, as well as gases, which are the result of burning the wide range of materials that were present in those buildings. Those people who were caught in the initial collapse, in the dust cloud that was generated by the collapse, had the worst exposures. But people who were down there over the ensuing weeks, when the fires were still burning intensely, had exposures to considerable amounts of dust as well as these highly irritant gases. And we know that that mix, that combination of exposures, is likely to produce inflammatory conditions of the airways, ranging from sinusitis to sore throats, laryngitis, and even asthma in people who are susceptible to these effects. This term World Trade Syndrome, which I don't like very much because it really combines a number of different clinical conditions into one term, is for the most part the result of exposure to these highly irritant materials.
Let me ask Wendy Tabb, did the EPA test your building?
No, not that I know of, no. The only testing that happened in our building was done by our landlord. He hired his own company to come in and do very, very superficial tests. They were air sampling tests for airborne asbestos. They were not aggressive tests. It happened at least 2 months after the event. So anything that was in the air is not anymore. It's been settled. Then the other testing that was done was independent tests that tenants, along with the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project, we hired our own industrial hygienist, and we found that there were 550 times what the EPA would consider a safe, if there is such a thing, level of asbestos in our ventilation system. And fiberglass was also found in one of the vents in an apartment, actually.
Dr. Levin, how bad is fiberglass?
Well, fiberglass is a highly irritating material, and people vary in their susceptibility to its effects. But some of the rashes that we've seen and heard reported among people who live and work down in that area are the result of fiberglass exposure. It is clear that if an individual already has a sinus condition, already has asthma, inhaling the fine particulate fiberglass dust will provoke the sinusitis or provoke the asthma and worsen the condition. There are probably some individuals who are so susceptible to the irritant effects of fiberglass and some of the other irritating dust there that they can experience for the first time in their lives new onset sinusitis and a condition that's very similar to asthma.
Wendy?
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment. Christine Todd Whitman, who's, you know, head of the federal EPA, made a couple comments that I just wanted to mention here. She, on the one hand, is saying how this is unprecedented, that the EPA has never experienced anything like this, the amount of toxins that were released from those buildings. But on the other hand, she says that it poses no risk to the residents or workers in the long term at all. I mean, she's very clear about that. Yet it is unprecedented, and they're still trying to understand it. So if something is unprecedented, there has been no research to see how all of these different contaminants react together as a toxic soup, how could she possibly say that it poses no health risk? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think one of the things that's also important to note in this is that when I called EPA on numerous occasions over the issue of what was going on in the private buildings, they took the position that it was not their responsibility to inspect and monitor the health situation in private buildings. Now, I, from the first, as a journalist, found that somewhat incredible, given the fact that while no one could predict or prevent the attack that happened and the collapse of these buildings, it is clear that they were publicly owned buildings. And therefore, when they collapsed, whatever contamination emanated from them, the source was a publicly owned building. Therefore, the governments, whether it's the Port Authority or New York City or the federal government, had to take some responsibility for determining the extent of the contamination caused by the collapse of those buildings. Interestingly enough, the week before September 11th, Christy Todd Whitman traveled to Libby, Montana. And in Libby, Montana, she notified the residents of Libby, Montana, who had been beset by enormous problems as a result of asbestos contamination of their homes because of a mining operation in Libby, Montana, a major contamination situation. She let those residents know that not only would EPA inspect all of their homes, but EPA would clean up every one of the private homes that had been contaminated as a result of the contamination from a private firm. Yet here in New York City, the EPA took the position that it had no responsibility for any possible contamination that occurred as a result of a catastrophe of publicly owned buildings. And I think that that's one of the things that Congressman Gerald Nadler is this morning having a press conference over that very issue and saying, why could the EPA have one policy for private homes and dwellings in Libby, Montana, and another for private homes and commercial private buildings here in New York City?
And Gerald Nadler is Democratic congressman here in New York City. You have, on the one hand, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, this weekend admitting that ambient asbestos in buildings around Ground Zero is nine times higher than is allowable. And you have the EPA cleaning their own building, but saying it is not necessary to clean the buildings around it. Joel Schuffer, what do you make of that? Rather, Joel Kupferman, what do you make of that? We'll be speaking with Joel Schuffer in a minute.
It's definitely unequal treatment. We went to the EPA at one time and asked their head asbestos enforcement person to go to Wendy's building to check out the asbestos. And we were told that they don't have the rights under their regulations because the asbestos came from the outside. And they even admitted that this asbestos, when it comes from the outside, is friable and much more dangerous. But we did point out that all they have to do is either declare it a Superfund site or a public health emergency. It gives them a lot more rights to enter, not just clean up the buildings, but also test in a much better methods.
And Wendy's building is no small building, is it?
It's 52 stories, and it's definitely caught.
It's a
huge residence, but also it's two, three blocks above their yellow perimeter line. And they basically arbitrarily drew a line, I believe, by Warren Street and then down Broadway, and saying that basically all the molecules and all the bad toxins that we found in all their reports don't travel any further. But a Superfund declaration or a public health emergency declaration could enable the EPA to act now and ensure, you know, proper cleanup.
I wanted to go to the area right around Ground Zero. Producer Miranda Kennedy went out yesterday to talk to people there. A lot of the workers were afraid to be on camera. But she was able to speak with one of the people who is working at a mobile health unit that was just put up 2 days ago. This is what she had to say.
Nora Rosenberg. I'm with the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems.
And you guys set up this World Trade Center medical monitoring unit on Monday? And I understand there was a long line of people waiting to get in.
We set it up on Monday. You know, we're only 3 days into it, and we've already, you know, almost pretty much exceeded the capacity that we're able to cover. There's a really big demand for this program. A lot of people who don't have doctors normally, let alone people who can talk to them about occupational exposures.
So what are the kinds of medical conditions that you're seeing with the people who've come to the clinic?
There are a variety of symptoms. A lot of people have different kinds of chest pains, coughs. Some people talk about bloody noses or coughing up blood. There are a fair amount of people with headaches. Some people are complaining of just general fatigue or body soreness, muscles, bones, feeling sore. A lot of irritated eyes. People say that the insides of their eyelids feel like they're burning. You know, and a lot of sore throats as well.
Do you put that down to the conditions in the air?
Well, part of our screening process is going through a long medical and occupational questionnaire with the patients. And there's a section where we say, have you experienced any symptoms, either new symptoms or worsened symptoms since September 11th? And a lot of them, you know, we do find a lot of new symptoms in that section. So, I mean, it's difficult to say for sure. It's a very uncertain field. You know, it's hard to say, you know, this is definitely the result of your job, but, you know, it's very likely that a lot of they certainly weren't feeling these symptoms before they started this kind of work.
And many of the people that I talked to said that they did clean up in the area or worked in the World Trade Center or apartments nearby. Is that what you found with the majority?
Yeah, it's a group of people that we don't hear about that much on the news. But after the towers collapsed, there was a lot of dust in the air and a lot of dust that settled in people's apartments and in offices. And that dust needed to be cleaned up. And the people who did this work were mostly Latino and Latina day laborers. A lot of times they would wait on the corner, you know, and every day it would be a question of whether or not they had work for that day. You know, a company would come by, pick them up, and tell them whether or not they had a job. You know, especially in the beginning, a lot of them weren't even being paid the wages they were promised, which weren't that high to begin with. You know, so it's a population that's doing very important work for the city, one that we don't really hear about much, one that's having a lot of medical problems, and, you know, is pretty desperate for some kind of care and, you know, or at least reassurance in some cases.
And do a lot of them express concern about coming in and not wanting to give their names? I mean, do you know anything about their legal status?
We don't ask them about their legal status. So, you know, some people will tell us voluntarily or it comes up in conversation, but I think we've, you know, the program has been successful and we've had such a high response because we're working with community-based groups that really can talk to these people, know their concerns, realize that they're, you know, concerned about their legal status, and have reassured them that, you know, we're not here to see whether they're legal or not. We're here to help them get medical care and to learn about what's causing their symptoms.
Nora Rosenberg from the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems at Queens College, which is one of the organizations that is set up the mobile health unit that is just off of Ground Zero, where many, especially Spanish-speaking workers, are going to try to figure out what's wrong. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Steve Levine, who I think is still on the line. Columbia University and some other researchers have begun a study of pregnant women who were exposed to toxic dust the first day or the days immediately after the World Trade Center collapse. As someone who has been studying the effects of chemicals on human beings for years, what are your concerns about the potential dangers to anyone who was pregnant and who was in the area when the buildings collapsed?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to respond in the way that you expect. I think it's a useful thing to do this study, and I'm not actually one of the researchers involved in this study, but I know the study well. I think that the exposures that pregnant women had, even early on, are unlikely to cause significant effect on the outcome of their pregnancies, because I believe that the dose of their exposure was probably too low to see a measurable effect. I'm not telling you that I know that for sure. This is on the basis of the data that I've seen thus far. But we know that somewhere in the order of 15% of all pregnancies, independent of this kind of exposure, end in adverse reproductive outcomes, either in miscarriage or a birth defect. And it will not be easy to determine whether, in fact, the exposures here have played any role, because the number of women are unlikely to be large enough, I think, to be able to detect a very significant effect. Nevertheless, I've been asked by a number of pregnant women what my view is as to whether they ought to continue to live or work in that area. And I said, I think that the likelihood that people will suffer a consequence in their pregnancy as a result of this exposure is low. But there are many women who would hound themselves for the rest of their lives because they stayed in that area if, in fact, the outcome of their pregnancy was unsuccessful, there was a miscarriage or some kind of birth abnormality. So there are psychological implications to this beyond the issue of toxic exposure.
Dr. Stephen Levin, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Dr. Levin is medical director at Mount Sinai Hospital in the Irving J. Selikoff Center for Occupational and Environmental Medicine as we talk about the toxic cover-up at Ground Zero. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're particularly going to look at what workers are dealing with around the site and what kind of protection they've had, what kind of information the government and their employers are giving them. Stay with us. Blood Makes Noise, Suzanne Vega here on Democracy Now! Out of Exile. This is The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look at toxic cover-up at Ground Zero. And I really want to emphasize again that Juan really did the first expose of what happened, what it was believed the toxins were at Ground Zero. We haven't seen as many reports as we'd like to see from you, Juan, in the New York Daily News. You're having some trouble getting them out there, aren't you?
Well, I've been a reporter in the mass media now for 25 years, and I'd have to say that I've never had more difficulty getting my reports into the newspaper, as I have had over the last few months, and an unusual number of questions from many of my editors over some of the stories and questions. And every time, of course, you can always come up with holes in stories, but every time you throw a whole new group of questions, that delays a story being able to get out in time to have an impact on what's going on.
And yet you forced an EPA response in your first story of dealing with the cover-up of the level of dioxin at Ground Zero, but then the follow-ups just didn't come back.
Well, one of the stories that I think has still not really been grasped by many people, which is one of the last ones I reported, was that there was an enormous amount of fuel and oils that were spilled in underneath the ground of the World Trade Center as a result of the collapse of the buildings, including 130,000 gallons that were lost by Con Edison when two substations were destroyed behind the World Trade Center 7, a 44-story building that also collapsed. To put it in perspective, the two planes that crashed had about 10,000 gallons apiece. The total fuel lost beneath the ground at World Trade Center was over 200,000 gallons, about 20 plane loads full of oil. And in the case of Con Edison's loss, it was also oils that were contaminated with, they say, low levels of PCBs. I'm still waiting for the documentation of that, because Con Edison does not have a sterling record in this state for properly reporting its spills. In fact, it's been tried criminally as well as civilly many times for misrepresenting the nature of spills. So as I told the Con Edison officials, you don't have a great track record, therefore I'd like more documentation on your allegations. And I'm still waiting for those. But they say it was low-level PCBs, but I think that there are many problems there. But I would like to get back to Marilena Cristodolo and the problems that the parents and the children at Stuyvesant High School are having, because here again it was another branch of government, the Board of Education, and also the city government, which they've been fighting over the issue of the fact that much of the debris of the World Trade Center is being removed from the site and offloaded onto barges 100 feet from the school. And I'd like to ask you what the impact of that has been on the school as well.
Well, you mentioned that we are four blocks from Ground Zero. I don't think we are four blocks. I mean, we're practically on top of Ground Zero, because this barge is the main disposal operation of all of the debris that's excavated and disposed from Ground Zero. So in addition with whatever the composition of the debris on any given day is at the barge, we have an additional problem, which is the diesel fumes and the combustion byproducts that are emitted by the trucks, the diesel fuel trucks that transport all of the debris, and by two huge cranes that are right on the barges to load and unload the debris.
And this is a 24-hour
operation. It's a 24-hour around-the-clock operation. As a matter of fact, the EPA, who has committed to us that they will inform us of anything that's above the regulatory levels, called me yesterday to inform me that there was an incident in late December of, and I'll try to pronounce it correctly, tetrachloroethane, which was above regulatory levels, and they said they believe it's fuel-related. Now, I'm not a chemist, I don't know. But the issue is that the EPA has its own monitoring station outside Stuyvesant at the barge location, and in late November, they reported that asbestos levels at that location were way above regulatory levels. And of course, we all know that regulatory levels, don't necessarily mean safe levels. So we're extremely concerned for two reasons. First, the barge is right there, so we're right on top of Ground Zero, practically. And second, the inside environment inside the school has been proven by now, because we've been there for 4 months, is really not healthy for our children. We have requested the Board of Education to install protective filtration in the ventilation system at the school to protect our children and to protect to block the contaminants from entering the school. To date, this has not happened, and we are extremely disappointed at the response of public officials, meaning the Board of Education and the city, to the parents' concerns.
I just want to add something for people around the country. Juan, in your New York Daily News, there's an exclusive from Tragedy to Soup Cans, Ground Zero Steel Being Recycled, a piece that says the charred steel girders from the World Trade Center, cut, melted, and reforged, will soon end up in hundreds of thousands of soup cans, appliances, car engines, and buildings across the world. About 60,000 tons of steel from the Twin Towers' once magnificent skeleton have been cut into manageable 3 to 5 foot lengths and loaded onto barges. While mostly bound for mills in South Korea, shipments also have made their way to Malaysia, Chicago, and Florida. The steel's swift journey from the smoldering piles at Ground Zero to recycling furnaces is a result of a controversial decision by the city to send the girders, columns, and beams to scrap yards in New Jersey, which then put them up for sale.
And of course, there are people who are in the engineering community who question whether this steel should have been cut up and sold off so quickly, because there are still many in the engineering community who are trying to figure out why these buildings collapsed, and who believe that a close examination of the steel girders of the World Trade Center would be evidence in such a continuing investigation. But the city's decision has sort of short-circuited a lot of those investigations.
As we come to the end of the program, we're joined by two people from NICOSH, which is the New York Committee on Occupational Safety and Health. Joel Shufro is executive director, and Omar Enriquez is safety and health specialist. Joel Shufro, can you put this in the context of other environmental disasters?
Well, Juan cited Libby, Montana. I think there's another example, which I think is really key here for New Yorkers will remember. Gramercy Park, 10 years ago, where a steam pipe blew and 200 pounds of asbestos were put into the atmosphere. At that time, the Department of Health declared a public health emergency, evacuated the area, evacuated the buildings, enclosed the buildings in plastic, sent in professional teams to clean the buildings up. This was a major effort on part of the health department and environmental agencies to do the job right. And if you compare that to what happened here, where tons of asbestos were put into the environment and in a much larger area, it's like you're on two different planets.
And in terms of the impact on a lot of the workers who have been had to do this cleanup, Omar, could you talk a little bit about what you've discovered and what you're attempting to do with NICOSH?
Sure. First, Amy, welcome back.
Oh, it's welcome great back. To as, be back on I, the airwaves with member, Juan and I, all, every all the Fired and Bam producers.
As a member of the Central American Exile Community, I know I share the feeling, but it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, in early October, I was alerted that workers were shaping up in a corner of Fulton and Broadway. We had discussed with Joel that probably the workers, as they were day laborers, were to go investigate. To my surprise, when I got there, most of the workers indeed were the day laborers, immigrant workers, and I like to just not to say they were undocumented, but that's besides the point. Whether they're documented or not, they were workers, and they were being picked up in the corner. And they were not being protected. They were not being offered any training, or they weren't being told what they were being exposed to. As I got to be a big, earn the trust of the workers there, I started finding out not only that they were cleaning the dust, and our previous guest said that the dust was clean on the rug. It was cleaned by immigrant workers. They were the first line of defense, like you could say, that prepare the buildings, the office buildings, and the apartment dwellings for New Yorkers to come in. And they weren't not only being given protective equipment, but they were only getting paid $60 a day for 8 hours, and $90 for 12. And to compound this even more, some of the workers were not even paid. They were not getting paid. So on October 17, I met with a New York Times reporter, Sumini Sumputa, and she broke the story. Mostly on the non-payment of wages, but we were still concerned because about the health of the workers, because I started hearing complaints about getting cough, nose bleedings, and that's when the effort to do something about the workers, the vulnerable workers, began. So on November 20, the first meetings were taking place with Dr. Steve Markowitz, Joel Shufro, and myself to kind of see the extent of the problem here about the workers being exposed. Some of the workers did not know that they were what they were being exposed to. They were only giving paper masks and sometimes no gloves. I mean, they didn't. When I asked them what kind of vacuum cleaners are you using, I said just regular vacuum cleaners. You know, HEPA. They didn't know what HEPA was. I mean, so we started a campaign of educating the workers about their rights, regardless of their legal status. And we were the first ones at NICOS to translate the fact sheets, the health fact sheets, to the workers. And I also contacted the National Employment Law Project to do an organizing drive in the corner, and also the Latin American Project to protect these workers. And we have seen now that their complaints, the symptoms range from nose bleedings to bronchitis, asthma, and some women have been able to trust me enough to say that they have irregularities in their periods. And they said, two of them told me that they thought that they were pregnant. And they said, I never had this before. So the problem is huge.
Joel Shifra.
And the problem extends beyond the workers who are doing the cleanup, who are at severe risk because they're disturbing the dust for 8 hours a day. But for office workers who were sent, and residents sent back to their apartments, there are no standards which are enforced or even on the books, unlike for students at the school where you have the AHERA law, which governs asbestos in schools. Workers really are at the mercy of their employer, who says, well, it's safe. And if they don't have a union to protect them to fight over these issues, they have virtually no recourse but to go back to work.
Well, one of the biggest concerns, of course, has been the firefighters and the rescue workers who for months were battling those fires and digging through the debris. And there was an interesting series of articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer about a year ago where a group of Philadelphia Inquirer reporters dealt with a chemical fire that had occurred in Chester, Pennsylvania in 1978 at an illegal chemical dump. And what they did is they went back and located over 200 firefighters and rescue people who had been involved in a 1.5-day fire. What they discovered was that over 40 of them, in less than 12 years, over 40 of them had died. And when they went back to look into their family histories, they found that the wives and relatives telling them that immediately after the fires, many of these men started developing rashes all over their bodies, started having major respiratory problems, and the Inquirer series concluded by, on the basis of epidemiological studies, that there were far more deaths among this group of firefighters than would have been expected in a comparable population size. But it took 12 to 13 years for the results of for the victims of that 1.5-day fire in Chester, Pennsylvania, to actually even be documented. And of course, this is the great concern that years from now, we're going to find out that there were not only 3,000 people who were killed in the World Trade Center, but many, many more. Who ended up suffering from the attack and from the failure of public health officials to adequately monitor the impact.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up this discussion. It's been a fascinating one, and it's certainly one we will continue to pursue. And Juan, now that you're back on Democracy Now!, whether or not the New York Daily News allows you to do these reports, you certainly have a forum here. I want to thank Omar Enriquez and Joel Shufro of NICOSH, New York Committee on Occupational Safety and Health, Wendy Tabb, resident at Ground Zero, as well as Dr. Steve Levin of Mount Sinai Hospital, and the whole PTA at Stuyvesant High School, very important, the story of what's happening to the kids. But our guest here in the studio, Marilena Christodoulou. If you'd like to get more information on the story, go to our website at democracynow.org, and it'll connect to everyone else's websites. That's www.democracynow.org. You can also email us, and it's great to get all the welcome home emails at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan's our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland, still our spiritual advisor at WBIX.org. And thank you to WBIX.org for faithfully broadcasting Democracy Now! And the other voices of the exiled over the past year. Thanks especially to KPFA, KFCF, and WFMU in New York that continued our broadcast. Democracy Now! Broadcasting from downtown Community Television. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now! Back from Exile. Makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice what she's stepping on. Maybe you go just